From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us, everyone. I'm Megan Mack. And actually, I shouldn't say us because it's just me here alone in the booth this week as I bring you the highlights from the talk show. Let's open the weekend with a story that every Rochesterian should know, but very few do. It's the story of what Frederick Douglass said and did when he was asked to give the preliminary address for a new monument in Washington, D.C. A little backstory for you. It was April 1876, exactly 11 years after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Reconstruction was not going well, and leaders hoped to galvanize the country with a new statue, a bronze monument featuring Abraham Lincoln with a kneeling black man at his feet. It displayed the word emancipation. That monument still stands in Washington, even though it's become controversial over the years. On Connections, we welcomed David Blight, a historian who has just published a massive new biography on Frederick Douglass. His book offers a detailed look at Douglass's speech that day, which did not go as organizers expected. Douglass was critical of Lincoln and held nothing back about the country's racist history. Let's listen.
It's April 14, 1876. It's the anniversary of Lincoln's death, but it's a monument that shows Abraham Lincoln standing and the slave, a generic slave, although it was modeled on a real person, kneeling, having his chains broken. It becomes known as the Freedmen's Memorial. It is in Lincoln Park, which is about 11 blocks up behind the U.S. Capitol.
It still is, right?
It still is. Oh, very much so. It dominates that park. At that point, that was actually the edge of Washington, D.C., but the setting was a huge parade organized by, put on by the black community of Washington. You had drum and bugle corps. You had fraternal orders. You had bands. And Douglass, the orator of the day, rode in the final carriage of this parade that went all over central Washington. The other extremely important element is that no black American had ever had that audience, which was the president, members of his cabinet, members of the Supreme Court, and members of Congress, all in front of him, as well as a lot of the public. No other black American had that audience until Barack Obama was inaugurated.
Isn't that amazing?
And Douglass hit it out of the park. President Grant unveiled the statue, but Douglass gave what I think is the second greatest speech of his life, the first still being the Rochester 4th of July speech. But the speech is his worry, his concern, deep concern about what's happening to Reconstruction. So go ahead, whatever passage you want to read.
So I admit, again, as a student of history, ignorant entirely of this moment, the story behind this memorial. And so I'm reading along, kind of hoping that Frederick Douglass wasn't just going to sort of acquiesce, not that he ever acquiesced, sort of do a cheerleading speech.
No.
And as you write, he opens very forcefully about, this new vision of a country that's more united.
Yeah.
But then he pivots a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So let me read from David's book. Douglass turned to the memory of Lincoln, and the speech assumed a different tone. While claiming a place for his people in honoring the martyred president, Douglass suddenly used words that may have shocked some in his audience. Quoting Douglass now, "It must be admitted, truth compels me to admit, even here in the presence of the monument we have erected to his memory, Abraham Lincoln was not either our man or our model. In his interests, in his associations, in his habits of thought, and in his prejudices, he was a white man." Blight goes on to write, "Douglass must have caused some squirming in the chairs as he injected race so forthrightly into his rhetorical tribute. Grant, President Grant, might have inwardly flinched. It was as though Douglass had decided to give voice to the kneeling slave on the statue, who would now say thank you as well as speak some bitter truths about a real history and not merely allow the occasion to be one of proud national self-congratulation. It was as though Douglass was saying, you gave me this unique platform today, and I will therefore teach these lessons about the jagged and tragic paths by which black people achieve freedom in the agony of war." And then quoting Douglass again, "Lincoln was preeminently the white man's president. Entirely devoted to the welfare of the white man, he was ready and willing at any time during the first years of his administration to deny, postpone, and sacrifice the rights of humanity in the colored people to promote the welfare of the white people of the country." End quote. In your assessment, Douglass employed a stunning level of directness for such a ceremonial occasion. What effect did it have?
Well, that's not clear, because I looked in the Grant papers in vain to find, what did Grant think of that
speech? Weren't you hoping for Grant to
God, I wanted to find that note where he either complained or rejoiced or something, and Grant must have gone back to the White House and taken a nap or something. But I don't know. But, you know, he goes on, that speech has yet another pivot. This is the genius of that speech. After laying that out and even going on to say, my fellow white Americans, you are Abraham Lincoln's children. I and my people are only his stepchildren. Whoa. You know, that you couldn't walk away from that speech and not remember that line. But then he pivots again and he says, but under his rule and in due time, and he uses that as a refrain three times, Lincoln, under his rule, and in due time, we became free, and the country was transformed. He just blisters his audience in that first part of the speech. But in the second part of the speech, he admits that Lincoln's caution probably was the only political path to emancipation. And under his rule, and in due time, becomes the refrain that he then takes it out with. So it's a speech that does what Douglas so often did. The first half is the Jeremiah that just makes you hurt and feel the pain in your history. The second part is the hope that maybe, just maybe, we've got something new. But what the speech ultimately is a statement about how Reconstruction is coming apart, is falling apart. And if this government that's sitting right in front of him doesn't do something right away, Reconstruction is lost. That's what the point of that speech is. He could have got up and just given some ceremonial, you know, flag waving, it's a beautiful spring day, but he didn't. He hit it out of the park, and I think it's one of his most brilliant addresses.
Next, a question. Can empathy be taught? Researchers say it can, and that incorporating empathy in conversations can create a more civil and compassionate society. We had a discussion about how to become more empathetic. In this clip, you'll hear from Sybil Prince, director of the Commons curriculum at the Harley School. She describes how the Harley School is teaching empathy through a program where 12th grade students volunteer in local hospice facilities.
Research has shown that it is through developing relationships with other people, it's by having interactions with them, that is how we build these neural pathways that are associated with empathy and compassion. So through the Center for Mindfulness and Empathy Education, we're doing that through some different experiential programs. One of those powerful programs is our hospice program, which is a year-long program for 12th graders in which they take a class learning about a taboo subject in our culture, which is death and dying and grief and loss. And while they're reading books and watching films and having these intimate, powerful discussions on this topic, they're also learning the hands-on skills of caring for somebody at the end of their life. And these are the personal care skills, the hands-on skills, but also the social-emotional skills of how do you remain present with somebody who is suffering? How do you remain present with someone who's grieving? How do we actively listen to them and talk with them in ways that communicate compassion, which I think is really hard for us as adults as well. You only have to ask somebody who's lost a loved one or who has a disenfranchised or an ambiguous loss, such as a divorce or a miscarriage or a diagnosis of an illness, and they'll tell you that people oftentimes don't know how to respond. They don't know what to say. And, you know, a few weeks after the funeral is over, they're gone. They're on to their own life, and people are feeling really alone. So these are really important conversations to be having.
What are the impacts that you see on students?
Huge. Well, actually, so just this morning, I was thinking as Shira was talking, just this morning, I had a student come in she had a shift over the weekend in one of the two-bed comfort care homes where the students are volunteering with people at the end of their lives. And she came in, she was all upset because she had been volunteering with one of the elderly residents there, and she felt like the family was really critical of her, that she could do no right, that they didn't like the way she repositioned the resident, they didn't like the way she was offering food to them. And she was so upset. And I could see the other students in the room around the table becoming more and more agitated, too. Like, oh, how dare they? Like, here you are coming in and volunteering your time. And they don't understand. I mean, that you're a volunteer. You're a student. And what other 17-year-olds go and spend their weekends volunteering with people who are dying? And after kind of beginning with that self-compassion, beginning with making sure she really felt heard and that her feelings were validated, those feelings of hurt and disappointment, it was moving on to then perspective taking of, okay, what would it be like to have your mother choose to be in hospice when you really wanted her to continue with her treatments? And you were feeling a lot of difficult anger, maybe you hadn't even named it for yourself, towards your mom for choosing this, for giving up. Or maybe the family was, you know, watching their mother disappear before their very eyes. What would that be like? And for a 17-year-old who's, you know, sitting comfortably in this space of invincible, sure, you know, they're feeling invincible, their parents are healthy and well, that can be really hard, but they can go there. And it can be really powerful, the conversations that come out of, you know, trying to imagine what is it really like to be in that position. And, you know, the class ended this morning with the students still feeling, you know, a little disgruntled and hurt, but there was this shift. And I think that's where the first steps in empathy begin.
Next, another question. How much do you know about dyslexia? The learning disorder affects more than 40 million Americans. People with dyslexia often have difficulty reading, spelling, and making connections between sounds and letters. Despite what you may have heard, people with dyslexia do not see letters backwards. That's a misconception. Dyslexia also comes with social and emotional complications for those affected by it. Many people feel embarrassed that they struggle with the challenges caused by dyslexia. This clip begins with Evan reading an email from a listener named Karen, whose seventh grader has dyslexia. You'll hear about the challenges he faces, and then you'll hear from two local experts, Cara Olds, a family education specialist at Starbridge, and Courtney Hathaway, a school social worker who has dyslexia. Here's Evan reading Karen's email.
My son was diagnosed with dyslexia in fifth grade. He has struggled with school since the beginning, reading, spelling, organization, and the diagnosis made sense. When he transitioned from elementary to middle school, somehow the information about his diagnosis did not follow him, and there was less support at the new grade level. While he had a successful year in sixth grade, he is now in seventh grade and struggling. He is very embarrassed about his diagnosis, and I struggle as a mom to comfort him and let him know that he is not stupid. Also, he is reluctant to advocate for himself, and I now find myself letting his current teachers know about his dyslexia because, once again, they seem to be unaware of his diagnosis. He has no current interventions besides paying for a tutor outside of school. What advice would you have for myself and my son moving forward? That's from Karen. There's a lot there. Cara, I'll start with you.
My first question is, does the child have an IEP, an individual education program? Because it's sounding like that may not be the case if the only supports that are available is an outside tutor, and that's often paid for by the family. So my first question would be, has he been evaluated and to find out where to have those struggles documented? That's a process, and we at Starbridge can always help and guide families through that if he doesn't have one. The other thing that could happen most immediately is to have a team meeting as well. Even though he's in middle school, is to find out, have the team meeting and have him be there as well. And he can talk about, you know, what is hard for him and what does he think would be helpful to be more successful in the school. That can be a little problematic if he's feeling self-conscious about that, but the mom can also be asking him ahead of time. And so if he's not comfortable talking or being at that meeting at that particular time, she can be his voice for him and say, I talked to him and these are some struggles that he's having and here's some solutions that he thinks might be easier. Or if he's not even sure, could pose it to the team. Hey, what else could we do?
I'm really feeling, you know, the hurt in this parent who's saying, he's embarrassed about it. He feels stupid at times. I don't know if he wants to be at a meeting like that, let alone be sort of grappling every day with what that means. What would you say?
And that's really common. And I think one of the most important things from my experience, my professional lens, is helping that child to understand what it is that they're struggling with. I use sometimes kind of the idea of a pie or a pizza, if you're dividing it up, as you can see that each section can represent something different. So if I were to tell you about myself, I would say, you know, I'm a sister and I'm a wife and I love to go to the beach and I love summertime. These are all different pieces of me. One piece is that I'm dyslexic and it's a learning disability. That's one piece, but that doesn't define who I am. But that's an important piece to understand. So what that might look like is helping that child to understand and to be exposed to, and this happens in small steps. It might be reading a story about it. It might be maybe their favorite athlete or singer or artist that they really are connecting with, looking in that field if anybody has dyslexia, because there's many people out there that do, so finding that common ground, and then helping to kind of peel back the different layers of what does it mean? It's not, you didn't do anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with you. Your brain thinks differently. And now that we know that, that's why we're going to put these things, accommodations or supports into place. A lot of times I see students not wanting, openly accepting the accommodations or wanting the help because they don't understand why you're giving it to them. So it's important, you know, there's a series of different steps that are taken. An IEP isn't just, you know, given just because you have that diagnosis. But what's important is if you have that diagnosis, what are the different things that can be helpful in your toolbox? And when you know what those are, you know what they are and why you're using them, you're that much more to accept them. So I think that's a really important piece. And then equally so, I kind of touched on this, that social-emotional piece of his self-confidence and his self-worth. He, all day long, is asked to do things that are really hard for him. So making sure that, you know, there's a positive outlet, may it be an extracurricular activity or something when he comes home that he gets to do. Or another thing is may it be volunteering or giving back. And the reason I say that one is because all day long, you're feeling like you need help from others. So if you have the opportunity to give back to someone more in that leadership role, that can really help to build a person up.
We'll end the week with a powerful conversation with Hilda Rosario Escher, the longtime president of the Ibero-American Action League. Rosario Escher announced her retirement in May after 27 years of service, 12, as president. Much like incoming president Angie Perez Delgado, Rosario Escher first came to Ibero as a client. In 1975, she attended English classes at the nonprofit after moving to Rochester from Puerto Rico. In this clip, she talks about growing up in poverty in Puerto Rico, navigating a difficult family life, and how she wouldn't let anything stand in her way when it came to getting an education.
It was very difficult. My childhood, my father worked in a sugarcane plantation. He was an alcoholic, no education. My mom had a third grade education and domestic violence. And at that time, girls were raised to basically be housewives. So at 6 years old, I was learning how to wash clothes, how to wash dishes. We lived in poverty. We lived in one bedroom house with one bed, and we were 8 kids. We took turns to sleep in the floor. When 4 o'clock came, I would go to the neighbors to see whether I could find a plate of food. But I always wanted to go to school because that was sort of my escape. And I would walk 2 miles to school with no shoes.
The childhood walk to school story, that's the absolute truth, isn't it?
Yes.
Two miles. Without shoes to school.
Yes. And so now I have lots of shoes. And you wonder why. So that's the reason. So, you know, I always enjoy going to school. However, I had no books, so I learned to read in third grade. And I think that the principal of the school that I was going to saw something that I basically didn't see.
And something in you?
Yes. Mm. And she would take me every day to her office and make me read to her so I could gain some fluency. And so when I went into fourth grade, I was already have learned to read and had some fluency, but they also saw that I was more advanced than the other kids. So I skipped fifth grade, went into sixth grade. So, and then from there, you know, my mom moved to the city. She divorced my father, and she basically found a job cleaning houses and tried to, you know, provide for us the best she could.
You were living where at the time?
In Santurce.
Okay.
Yeah. That's about 10 minutes from San Juan.
Okay.
And then, you know, she got married and there was another story. So at that point, there was, you know, sexual abuse and all of that. So, but nothing stopped me. You know, I have always been very resilient. What I'm told to do, if I don't think that is the right thing, I just go and do something else. Or what I think is better for the occasion, better for me. And so I went to college on a scholarship. I entered the University of Puerto Rico, that even though it's a public university, is probably the most difficult university to get in. So I got in the University of Puerto Rico and I studied. Then I came, when I finished, my brother said, why don't you come here? And
here to
Rochester.
To Rochester.
Yes, because he had moved here from New York City.
And why? So he was in New York City and moved to Rochester?
Yes.
For work?
He had some friends there, mm-hmm. and there was too much going on in New York City, so his wife didn't like it. So they moved here, and I think that he was feeling a little lonely. He wanted to have more family members here. So I had just finished the university. I came here. I came in the summer. And then in the winter, I was wearing a leather jacket with sandals. No one told me. So I would freeze every day.
And regret it?
I regret it.
Did you regret it at first?
Oh, gosh, yes. What am I doing here? I mean, in the summer, it's beautiful. But anyway, that's the time when I started at Ibero. I came and my family say, why don't you go to Ibero to learn English? And I say, okay.
Hilda went on to be hired by Ibero and moved up the ranks in the organization. Be sure to listen to that full hour with Hilda and the new Ibero president, Angie Perez Delgado. It's an hour you don't want to miss, and you can find it on our podcast page. And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. You can also find us on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will talk to you Monday. I'm Megan Mack, standing in for Evan Dawson, who maybe will make do the whole podcast himself next week. We'll see. Have a great weekend.